Robert Caro's latest installment in his life of Lyndon Baines Johnson, The Passage of Power, took 12 years to produce, is 600 pages long and barely covers 4 years. It picks up where his master of the Senate left off, when Senator Johnson, pondering a run for the 1960 Democratic nomination, had to make a major decision. This book covers his 3 unhappy years as vice president, the Kennedy assassination, LBJ's ascension to the presidency, and ends with the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1964. It's published by Alfred A. Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Robert Caro back to our show today. Welcome.
Great to be back.
Now, I just have to clear something up. In the recent New York Times Magazine article about you, Charles McGrath claimed that his copy of The Passage of Power was 736 pages. How do I get those missing pages?
You have the right copy.
His was the large type copy. 39 years after his death, Lyndon Baines Johnson continues to fascinate us. Is that because, the Vietnam War aside, he was, on the one hand, forgive me for saying this, a lying, bribe-taking, manipulative politician, a philanderer, and an absentee father, but on the other, a Southerner who was intent on transforming the American, transforming all of American politics from a bastion of Southern obstructionism into an agent of social change?
I think that that's exactly why he fascinates people. It's the contrast between this crude, manipulative, sort of ruthless, at times vicious human being, who at the same time was the most effective legislator for the poor, and particularly poor color, that we've ever had.
Well, after all of the time you've spent thinking and writing about him, have you figured him out?
Well, sometimes you do find yourself saying, as he's doing a legislative thing, now he's going to do so-and-so. And then he does it, and you say, oh, you're getting to understand him. Sometimes he does things that really pass understanding.
Well, you go back to earlier in his life in this when you start off this book. Is that to explain how he became the man you're writing about in this volume?
Oh, exactly. And it's such a it's so interesting. After Kennedy's assassination, he has to pick up Kennedy's civil rights program and tax cut bill and get him through. But then he says to a group of friends one Sunday night in his home in December, less than a month after the assassination, you know, if I want to run for president in my own right, I have to get my own program. He goes back down to the ranch and he creates the War on Poverty. I know you've read in the first book, we see how he grew up in poverty, how he hated poverty, and so much that he made up a whole alternative story about his youth. So, because he was ashamed, shouldn't have been ashamed, but he was ashamed of the way he grew up.
How old was he when his family lost its money and its power?
13 and 14.
Because his father had been a politician.
His father had been a very successful Texas legislator and a successful real estate man in the Hill Country. Then he bought the Johnson Ranch just as cotton prices plummeted and lost the ranch. And Lyndon spent the rest of his boyhood in a house where he was literally afraid every month that it would be taken away from them.
We talk a lot about Lincoln and the backbreaking work he did when he was young, but you talk about Johnson as a teenager working a backbreaking job on the road building crew and telling people during the breaks that he was going to be president.
Yes. You know, you have to really picture this. The Hill Country is this vast, open, empty space. And in the middle of it, there's this little road gang of 7 or 8 men building. It wasn't a paved road. It was a graveled road between Austin and Fredericksburg. And 7 or 8, the rest of the gang are all men in their 20s. Lyndon Johnson is 17 and 18. And I spoke to one of the guys who worked with him, a guy named Ben Kreider. Said, you know, he was too skinny for that kind of work. It was backbreaking work. But every lunch hour when we broke, he would sit there and tell us that he was going to be president of the United States one day.
Well, many people say that, and only a few actually achieve it. And then we move ahead to 1959, and he is master of the Senate, one of the most powerful men in Washington, and thought it was his time to run for president. But here's this decisive man who'd been talking about his ambition to become president since he was a teenager, and he's suddenly reluctant to declare.
You know, it's such a poignant thing. He couldn't stand, you know, his brother, Sam Houston Johnson, once said to me, you know, the most important thing for Lyndon was not to be like Daddy. His father had failed. He was afraid of failing, and he was afraid if he ran for president, he might fail. And it was John Connolly, who was his campaign manager, said to me, you know, if he didn't try, he couldn't fail. So he didn't try.
Well, but he did realize that there were certain liabilities. No Southerner had become president since the Civil War at this point. It's interesting how many have since.
Yes. He realizes it's going to be tough, and it's ultimately, you know, one of the reasons that he accepted the vice presidency and traded in this enormous power as the most powerful Senate majority leader in the history of the country for the powerless job of vice president.
But did he believe that he could become the nominee without running? Was he hoping for a brokered convention?
Well, he has a strategy, and it's not a bad strategy, which is to keep Kennedy from winning on the first ballot. Throw the convention into the back rooms. Who's the back rooms? His friends. David Lawrence. David, don't call me Boss Lawrence of Pennsylvania. Dick Daley of Illinois. Pat Brown of California. Carmine DiSapio of New York. These are Lyndon Johnson's natural allies. He thinks if he can get the convention into the back room, he'll win.
And Newt Gingrich probably had the same strategy until fairly recently in his run for the presidential nomination. What did he think of Jack Kennedy?
You know, Johnson despised Kennedy when he was in the Senate.
But he was good at reading people. Why did he misread him?
I have a lot. You know, Lyndon Johnson was a great reader of men. And I have a line in the book that I'm proud of having written, so I'm going to repeat it for you. This great reader of men, this man who thought he could read any man, had read one man wrong. Now, it was easy for Johnson to misread Kennedy because Kennedy had this, he was very ill when he was in the Senate in the first few years. And he had these two horrible back operations where his back was just cut open for 8 inches. And he didn't do much. And Johnson was later to say, Kennedy was pathetic. He was sickly. You know what he used to do? He used to make a little circle with his fingers and say, you know how big his ankles are? This big around. He said he wasn't a man's man.
He had also turned down an interest in an oil well because he saw it as a political liability. This is a man who really thought about every possible problem that he might face.
It shows how much he wanted to be president. You know, he hated being poor. And the incident that you talk about, which no one else ever picks out, which I think is one of the crucial defining incidents in his life, is when he's in his mid-30s, two of his Texas financial backers, oil men, offer him a share in a well. He doesn't have to put up anything, and he'll be rich. And he thinks about it for a couple of days, and he says, I can't do it, because being an oil man would kill me politically. And these two men think, you know, what is he talking about? It can't hurt him in his congressional district. It won't hurt him if he runs for Senate. And then they know that he wants to be president, and he wants it so badly that he'll give up this for it.
Because other people, even today in Congress, are very happy to take the interest in the oil well.
Yes,
they just passed some legislation that supposedly is eliminating that possibility, and it probably won't anyway. At the convention, did Johnson still think he had a chance of becoming the nominee?
Yeah, he thinks he has it. You know, Leonard, he almost stops Kennedy. People forget this. Kennedy, when they get to Wyoming, near the very end of the ballot, he still doesn't have the necessary votes. He doesn't in Wyoming. The Kennedys have negotiated a deal, Teddy Kennedy, the younger brother, with the chairman of the Wyoming delegation. Now, Wyoming has 15 votes, and 10 of them are for Kennedy. But Teddy Kennedy gets the chairman of the delegation before the convention, and he says, if it comes down to your delegation, will you give us the other 5 votes? And it's terrific. You see, they're up to Wyoming. Kennedy 10 votes is not going to give him the required number. Walter Cronkite says something like, oh, I see Teddy Kennedy hurrying across the floor toward the Wyoming delegation. And you see, and Teddy Kennedy told me, you know, I reminded him of his promise. He said, I never thought it would come down to the last 5 votes, but they give him the 5 votes, and that's how Jack Kennedy gets the first ballot.
Because I always had the sense that the momentum was with Kennedy. And that always is an important factor in who winds up getting the nomination.
I think that you're right. You know, the momentum was with Kennedy, but Johnson had a strategy that came within a hair of working.
So the final count was very close?
Well, the final count was 806 to 409, but a number of delegations switched after Kennedy got it. They switched to him.
So here we have these two men that don't like each other. And yet Kennedy asks him to be his running mate. Did he do it? Was that a sincere offer, or was it meant as a kind of conciliatory gesture because he knew that Johnson was going to be the majority leader in the Senate and sure did not need any obstruction from him?
Well, you know, there's so many versions, so many explanations of why Jack Kennedy, you know, the 8 o'clock in the morning after the Kennedy wins the nomination, he telephones down to the – he's on the 9th floor of the Biltmore Hotel. Johnson's on the 7th. He telephones down, and Lady Bird answers, and he says he'd like to come down and see Lyndon Johnson. They make an appointment for 10 o'clock. Kennedy comes down. For whatever reason, they both come out of it with the impression that Kennedy has offered him the nomination. Kennedy is sure he's going to take it. Johnson hasn't actually accepted. He said, I can't accept it unless Sam Rayburn approves. Kennedy goes back up, and he's sure he's going to take it. And there's this wonderful photograph of the moment he comes up, and Dave Lawrence of Pennsylvania, who knows that he has to have he has to have Texas, and he has to have some of the states that Eisenhower took away in 1956 from the Southern, and Kennedy comes in and says something to the effect, it looks like he hasn't said he'll take it, but it looks like he will. And there's an actual photograph of that moment that Lawrence, this tough old Irish politician, reaches across the room and stretches out his hand and takes the hand of the young Irish politician, Jack Kennedy, because they feel that they've got the race now.
My guest is Robert A. Caro. Latest book in his massive biography of Lyndon Johnson is The Passage of War. It is published by Knopf. This is WNYC, WNYC.org.
The Passage of Power.
Of Power. When I say war, I looked right at it, at power, and I said war. Well, it often one leads to the other. I'm Leonard Lope. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. Okay, so Jack understands that having Johnson on board is really important to him. But Bobby had 3 or 4 conversations in which he asked LBJ not to accept. This was a personal thing?
Well, you know, there's so many stories. I'll tell you what we know about it. Bobby Kennedy hated Lyndon Johnson. And Lyndon Johnson hated Bobby Kennedy. You know, as a historian, you're reluctant to use a word as strong as hatred, but it's not too strong in this instance.
And it goes all the way back to 1953?
It went back to their very first meeting. You know, someone said of this meeting, one of the guys watching it, did you ever see two dogs who don't know each other come into a room and suddenly there's a low growl and the hair rises on the back of their neck? This is what happens. The first meeting, Johnson is the leader, and he always has breakfast in the Senate cafeteria, which is in the 2nd floor of the Senate office building. So does Senator Joe McCarthy. And Bobby Kennedy has just joined his staff. He's a new staff. He's 27 years old. McCarthy and his staff sit at a big round table right near the cashier. And every Johnson comes in with George Reedy and Horace Busby, two of his aides. And McCarthy jumps up, as all senators do, to give Johnson deference. Good morning, Mr. Leader. Anything I can do for you, Mr. Leader? Great job yesterday, Mr. Leader. And everybody, all his staff jumps up to shake Johnson's hand, except Bobby Kennedy. He just sits there. Johnson, you know, he knows what to do in every, that situation, and he just forces Bobby Kennedy. He sticks out his hand a little way, so Bobby Kennedy has to get up.
And the fact that Kennedy is working for Joe McCarthy, the most hated man as far as the Democrats are concerned, that doesn't play any part in this? It's just simply the handshake that was important?
Well, there was Johnson had been telling around Washington for years. You know, he was Franklin Roosevelt's protege. And, you know, Robert Kennedy's father, Joseph Kennedy, was Roosevelt's ambassador to Great Britain. And Roosevelt had once tricked Joe Kennedy, who was planning perhaps to endorse Wendell Willkie in 1940. He had tricked him into coming back and then fired him. And Johnson used to tell this story, and of course Bobby Kennedy loved his father, and I think that played a role in it too. But the rest of it was something just chemical.
Now, you have to wonder why Johnson would accept the vice presidency. This is a big step down for him in terms of power.
Yes, but you know, as you said before, all his life he only wanted one thing, to be president. And he had analyzed things. He used to say, you know, no Southerner is going to get the nomination in my lifetime. The votes in the Democratic Convention, you know, are controlled by these northern states. He actually, and this is a route, the president after, if you're a vice president, you're not a Southerner anymore, you're a national figure, after 4 or 8 years, you may be the logical choice.
How old would Johnson have been?
Well, Johnson was born in August 1908, so if we say 1968, he still would be
60 years old,
yeah.
But this is a tricky thing because an awful lot of vice presidents who had pretty much had no power wound up looking powerless when they finally decided to run. You describe a scene in the Adolphus Hotel in Dallas that might have led to Kennedy winning in Texas. What happened there?
Well, it's this whole election, Leonard, you know, after the result is in, everything seems clear. Kennedy had the momentum. In fact, it wasn't clear. And I think this is the very last week before the election. I don't remember. But Nixon is, Eisenhower had carried Texas twice. The last time he carried it in a landslide, over 200,000 votes. Nixon is ahead in the polls in Texas. When Johnson and Lady Bird get to their hotel to
despite be met, the fact that Johnson is running as vice president,
Johnson,
favorite son?
That's nonetheless the fact. But they walk into their hotel, the Adolphus Hotel, and there's a convention of what today we would call the Tea Party. Then they would join Birch's. Right-wing people, haters. And they have big placards, you know, calling Lyndon Johnson. One says Judas for running with Kennedy. And they start waving these placards and blocking the path of Lyndon and swarming around Lyndon and Lady Bird so that the television cameras capture a hostile mob with Lyndon and petite Lady Bird going through it. And it's just turned the tide in Texas and was a key element in Johnson carrying this and Kennedy carrying this thing.
One of the two things, the other being what some people say Richard Daley pulled off in Cook County.
Well, Johnson also, you know, had the border counties, the Rio Grande counties, counting for him also.
My guest is Robert Caro, and his latest book is called The Passage of Power. It is published by Knopp. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we're back with Robert A. Caro, who's written now the fourth installment of The Years of Lyndon Johnson, this one called The Passage of Power, published by Knopf, and of course I got it wrong, but would you say that your books are studies of how political power works and how America's changed as a result?
Yes. That's exactly what I'm trying to do.
So you've said you set out to explain how political power really works, not what we were taught in the textbooks. Is Lyndon Johnson the best person to look at for that?
Yes, because, I looked at first Robert Moses, and I thought of that book. You know, I've never been interested in doing a biography just to tell the story of a great man. I always wanted to study how political power worked, because I came to feel when I was a reporter that, after all, power comes from the ballot box, or we think it does. And the more we make the decisions, therefore the more we understand about political power, the better our democracy should be.
But the cliche of power corrupting, it doesn't always apply.
I don't feel it always applies. And I can tell you out of my books, power doesn't always corrupt. Sometimes power cleanses. In the cases of Al Smith, the governor, and Sam Rayburn, they were like tough, ruthless politicians until they got power, and then they used it for noble ends.
Because they understood they had a responsibility.
Yes.
At what point in his life did Johnson realize power was his sustenance? I mean, could he have lived without it?
You know, you see, you ask a very good question. Could he have lived without it? During the 3 years that he's vice president, he loses so much weight that you see his suits are falling off him. He has an expression, you know, he gets so thin that his jowls hang down that they call it a hangdog look. You watch him walk, his stride, you know, he used to have that old long swinging Texas stride. His stride is shorter. He's a man almost broken. You know, someone says of him, he's like a great bull who's been castrated late in life.
Although immediately after the election, he came up with a few schemes for making the vice presidency a basis of power. What did he suggest that his role in the Senate would be? And did Mike Mansfield think that was a good idea?
You know, Johnson says, power is where power goes. No matter where I go, I'll have the power because I'm me. And that's been true all his life. So he comes up with this scheme. And part of the scheme is that he's still going to preside over the Democratic caucus. He's still going to run the Democrats in the Senate like he used to. And therefore, Kennedy would be dealing with him. He wouldn't just be Kennedy's subordinate anymore. He'd be a man with an independent power base. However, the senators won't have someone from the executive branch, and he loses. Then he tries a maneuver.
Well, he said that the meeting he had with them taught him the difference between a cactus and a caucus, but I'm not sure you can explain that on family radio.
If you can, I'll let you do it.
Okay. But he was obviously a witty man as well. Or is this kind of like a Texas folksiness?
Lyndon Johnson, had some great, Lyndon Johnson has great expressions about, I think I can tell this one on a family thing. When he was president, he liked to go out in the back porch of his ranch at night and urinate off the porch. One night there's a Secret Service man there, and he says, "Watch out for rattlesnakes." And Lyndon Johnson says, "It is part rattlesnake."
Well,
could I tell that on the air?
He did. he would definitely like to brag about certain things like that. So he also thought that that JFK would give him more responsibilities.
Yes,
he wanted an office in the White House.
He wants an office in the White House. He actually drafts an executive order that he thinks he can get Kennedy to sign, giving him supervision of different departments of government.
So had he overestimated his personal ability to make something of the vice presidency?
He underestimated Jack Kennedy. And after this incident, he says to George Reedy, I think it is, his press secretary, he's a lot smarter than I thought he was, and a lot tougher, too.
On the other hand, was JFK missing an opportunity? Since LBJ was obviously a very effective politician, why didn't Kennedy use Johnson's expertise to help him get his legislation through Congress? Because he faced a lot of opposition for his proposals.
That's a telling point. Here Kennedy has the greatest legislator, the greatest bill passer, certainly in the 20th century. and he doesn't use them. You know, he puts Lawrence O'Brien, an aide in charge of Congress, and Johnson says, you know, it's been for in 2 years, Lawrence O'Brien has never asked me for a piece of advice. When Kennedy introduces his civil rights bill, Johnson has to tell Ted Sorensen, another Kennedy aide, I don't know what's in the bill. I had to read it in the New York Times.
So people must have noticed that this man who was had been so feared because of his power had no power anymore.
Oh, people notice it, all right. You know, Washington's a very cruel town. To be without power in a town where power is the currency, people sneer at you.
And there was a headline in one of the newspapers, Where is Lyndon?
Whatever happened to Lyndon Johnson, another headline says.
Now, at what point did his interactions with the administration begin to comprise mostly of having to deal with Bobby?
Well, Bobby Kennedy, you know, is closer and closer to his brother. He is becoming the closest man to his brother. And he is determined to humiliate Lyndon Johnson. And he does everything he can. You know, Johnson can't even get a plane to take him to an appearance someplace unless Bobby Kennedy signs off on it.
That must have really had an odd effect when Bobby was running for president later to as the next Democrat to replace Lyndon Johnson, or had they worked it out by then?
Oh, they certainly hadn't worked it out.
Was Johnson included in the deliberations that happened during the Cuban Missile Crisis?
Yes, he was. And, you know, in one part of this book, I go into the Cuban Missile Crisis in great detail because Lyndon Johnson's role has never been really explored. And it's a role that led Jackie Kennedy to later write to Ted Sorensen, you must know how frightened my husband became that Lyndon Johnson would ever become president.
Because he was very hawkish, whereas, to I'm sure everyone's surprise, Bobby was a calming influence during those deliberations.
Well, Bobby was, you know, when the hawks are saying to Jack Kennedy, we must, you know, after we discovered the missiles, we must attack, we must bomb, Bobby Kennedy sends his brother a note. Do you know what it says? It says, now I know how Tojo felt when he was planning Pearl Harbor. And he says to this room, we're not that kind of a country that would have a sneak attack. And people in the room says, you know, it was like we were watching this moral force suddenly unveiling itself.
So can we intuit in Johnson's style here that some of the things that are going to happen later with Vietnam?
Well,
even though that's not in this book, yeah, we should point out.
Yeah, well, I think that if you're interested in Vietnam, what happens in the deliberations of XCOM, the executive committee, over the Cuban Missile Crisis really give you food for thought as to what the two presidents would have done.
And then Johnson's protege, Bobby Baker, becomes embroiled in a scandal. That couldn't have helped.
No, you know, at the very moment that the Kennedy, you know, all in the book, I mean, it's hard to write. It seems so dramatic that you write it and you look down at your notes. Do you really have this? You know, at the very moment that Kennedy's motorcade is going through Dallas, a witness back in a little room in the Senate office building is testifying to the Senate Rules Committee about Johnson's involvement in this burgeoning scandal and pushing documents across the table.
Where was Johnson's car in that motorcade?
Third car. You had Kennedy's car. Behind it, you had a car crammed with Secret Service agents. Then they always had a 75-foot gap. And then the third car was the vice president's car.
And there were rumors that he was a bit of a physical coward, wasn't there? He had done everything to avoid combat in World War II.
Yes, people said that about him, except those who had seen him in actual moments of danger when he was very calm.
One of the amazing images in the book is Johnson's ability to take control, his confidence and lack of fear in the wake of tragedy. People noted immediately a change in him after Kennedy was shot. How was it described?
Well, you know, he's standing. The Secret Service agents have rushed him into Parkland Hospital. They found him a secure place. It's the last cubicle in what they call the minor medicine section of Parkland. Johnson is standing there against the far wall. Lady Bird is sitting on a chair beside him. Johnson, in front of Johnson is a Secret Service agent. In the room between that cubicle and the corridor are two other agents. And at the door is a secret agent, secret service agent, who's been stationed with orders not to let anyone past him unless he actually knows his face.
But he was, no matter what he did, he seemed to invite some criticism. He was criticized bitterly for his call to Bobby Kennedy, even though you could make a case for him doing it out of respect.
You can make that case, but in human terms...
You think he was rubbing in the fact that he was, I'm now in charge.
Well, you imagine yourself, how would you like to call the brother of a man who has just been killed a half hour later and say, what's the formalities of my taking his job?
He did invite Jackie to be there at the swearing-in.
Yes. And Jackie accepts and she says, you know, for the sake of history, I should do it.
There were all sorts of disagreements as to whether they should even go back on the plane, stay there. Is this all relevant to understanding?
Johnson, absolutely. I mean, you say in the hospital, they said, we've got to get you to Air Force One and get you back to Washington. We can make it secure. But Johnson says, I'm not going back without Jackie Kennedy. Then they say, she won't go back without her husband's body. He says, then we're going to wait on this plane until the coffin is here.
We have a clip of Lyndon Johnson speaking to the nation in the wake of the assassination.
All I have, I would have given gladly not to be standing here today. An assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency. No memorial oration or eulogy could more eloquently honor President Kennedy's memory than the earliest possible passage of the Civil Rights Bill for which he fought so long.
I remember at the time many people felt that part of the problem for Johnson was that he never sounded sincere when he delivered a speech. I still get letters from listeners claiming that LBJ was behind the assassination. Is that why he decided to create the commission to investigate it?
Well, he knew that he had to have a commission. You know, it wasn't just the possibility of his involvement. The headlines then... they were later disproven, but what you remember them. You know, it says, suspect, that's Lee Harvey, visited Soviet embassy in Mexico City. Suspect visited the Cuban embassy. These rumors, I mean, he says to Earl Warren, you know, in getting him to head the commission, he says, you know, you don't want to do it, but if these rumors get started and Russia gets worried, we have a possibility of a nuclear confrontation.
Now, he comes into Washington at a time when it's really been hard for JFK to pass most of his major legislation. And you say that the stalemate between the White House and Capitol Hill had gone on for 25 years, and the only person who'd been able to free the logjam had been Lyndon Johnson. But that was when he was in the Senate. He was able to do it again when he became president,
you know,
and almost immediately?
You know, the marvelous thing. I mean, it's unbelievable. In this book, I devote so many pages to what he does right after he takes over, because he gets these two bills, Kennedy's Civil Rights Bill and Kennedy's Tax Cut Bill, which really were stuck. They were stalled. They weren't going anywhere in Congress. And in a matter of days, he gets both of them moving again.
And he does it through understanding how the Senate and House work, which is something that we've seen other presidents have real problems with.
Well, Johnson knew exactly how the Senate worked. He knew the people. He knew which buttons, what they wanted.
Now, how important was the passage of civil rights legislation for him in terms of what he felt was the moral thing, and how much of it was also his understanding that he probably would not be reelected or elected for the first time if the North didn't vote for him?
Well, you know, with Johnson, everything is a combination of the political and the personal. But we know that Lyndon Johnson, from the time he was 20 years old, wanted to help poor people, and particularly poor people of color. I don't know if I have time to tell, but you know, when he was 20, he has to drop out of college for a year to earn money to go on. He teaches in what they called the Mexican school down in a little village near the Rio Grande border. And I wrote in the first volume, no teacher had ever cared if these kids learned or not. This teacher cared. And he's president now, and he says to somebody who says, don't put all your political capital into civil rights. He says, I'll tell you something. I swore then that if I ever had a chance to help these kids, I'd do it. And now I have the power, and I'll tell you something, I mean to use it.
And you tell a story about him, in effect, integrating a segregated nightclub on New Year's Eve by arriving with a black staff member.
Yes.
So they weren't going to refuse the president and his staff member. And then from then on...
The next day, a professor, it's in Austin, he arrives there on New Year's Eve with Jerry Whittington, he's appointed his first black secretary, made her a sperm, and he says, let's go integrate the 40 Acres Club, and he brings her there, and of course, no one dares say anything.
So he's first intent on getting all of JFK's legislation passed, but then you say he came up with the war on poverty.
Yes.
It didn't grow at all out of any Kennedy initiatives?
Well, the possibility of having poverty legislation had been started on the Kennedy, but it hadn't really gone anywhere. It wasn't being pushed at all.
A listener, Jim, asks, I know this, you're going to deal with this in the next book, what are your views about whether President Kennedy was trying to wind down involvement in Vietnam and the extent to which LBJ was responsible for the escalation?
Well, I tell you, I'll have to take a pass on that for the reason you said that's in the next book.
But was Vietnam was already there, wasn't it?
Yes.
One of the things he was going to he was dealing with on a regular basis?
Well, it wasn't an over... Johnson was later to say he had a breathing space in foreign affairs, including Vietnam, for about 2 months.
Now, you've said in the past you always know the last sentence of your next book. Have you already written the last sentence of the next book?
Yes.
And is the next book going to be the last book?
You know it.
But you probably won't go to
but
the
why
end.
Would you? But why would you believe me? You asked me that with this book.
Yeah, well, I asked you after the first book how many more books. You said maybe one more. Yeah. Now, Robert Caro will be speaking and signing books at the Barnes & Noble store at Union Square tonight at 7 o'clock. I'm assuming that pretty much all of the research has been done. Is it just simply now a matter of sitting down and writing it?
Yeah.
So many of the people you had to interview are no longer with us, for example.
I've done most of the research for the last volume already because I thought it was going to be all part of one book.
Mm. You thought it was going to be one book?
I thought the book that you're holding was going to go to the end of his life.
So what happened? Is it just you found too many really interesting things?
Well, that's one way of putting it. But I also felt I'm trying to study various forms of political power. If I focus on – that's why it's called the passage of power. The passage, the transition from the Kennedy administration to the John – from one president to another. I want to – here you have a president who comes in a time of great crisis and seizes the reins of power. I want people – I want to try to describe and people in a way that I hope people will read what it means to take over the presidency. You know, today we say there's an 11-week transition period, and every political scientist says that's not long enough. Johnson has 2 hours and 6 minutes.
But there's another important clue here. It isn't the biography of Lyndon Johnson. It's the years of Lyndon Johnson. You want to encompass all the other things that were happening during this time?
Yes.
So do you see this as kind of a history of America during the years that Lyndon Johnson was alive?
Well, that I don't say that I succeeded in doing that, but that's what I'm trying to do.
Robert A. Caro's The Passage of Power, The Years of Lyndon Johnson. It is published by Albert Knopf, and remember, he will be speaking and signing books at the Barnes & Noble store on Union Square tonight at 7 o'clock. You might want to stop by and say hello.